ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। ॐ नमो भगवते वासुदेवाय। श्रीमद्भागवतम् 10th canto, chapter 63, text 30 through 34. Ityukto chutam ananya gato maheshwaro jvara banas turatam aruda pragadyochan janardhanam ityukto chutam ananya gato maheshwaro jvara banastu ratam aruda pragadyochan janardhanam ityukto chutam ananya gato maheshwaro jvara Banastu ratam aruda pragadyochan janardhanam Vaishnavis. Iti, thus, ukta, addressed, achutam, to Krishna, the infallible Supreme Lord. Anamya, bowing down, gata, went, maheshwara, of Lord Shiva. Dwara, the fever weapon. Bana, Banasura. Two, but. Ratam, his chariot. Aruta, riding. Pragat, came forward. Yochyan, intending to fight. Janardhanam, Lord Krishna. Translation. Thus addressed, the Maheshwara Dwara bowed down to the infallible Lord and went away. But Banasura then appeared, riding forth on his chariot to fight Lord Krishna, carrying numerous weapons in his thousand hands, O king. The terribly infuriated demon shot many arrows at Lord Krishna, the carrier of the disc weapon. As Bana continued hurling weapons at him, the Supreme Lord began using his razor-sharp chakra to cut off Banasura's arms as if they were tree branches. Lord Shiva felt compassion for his devotee, Banasura, whose arms were being cut off, and thus he approached Lord Chakrayuta, Krishna, and spoke to him as follows. Sri Rudra said, "You alone are the absolute truth, the supreme light, the mystery hidden within the verbal manifestation of the absolute. Those whose hearts are spotless can see you, for you are uncontaminated like the sky." Purport. The absolute truth is the source of all light and is therefore the supreme light, self-luminous. This absolute truth is explained confidentially in the Vedas and is therefore difficult for an ordinary reader to understand. The following statements quoted by Srila Jiva Goswami from the Gopala Tapani Upanishad show how the Vedic sounds occasionally reveal the absolute. Te hotu upasanam etasya paratmano govindasya kila dharino bruhi. They, the four Kumaras, said to Brahma, "Please tell us how to worship Govinda, the Supreme Soul, and the foundation of all that exists." Chaitanas chaitananam. He is the chief of all living beings. And tangha devam atma vritti prakasham. One realizes that Supreme Godhead by first realizing one's own self. The great Acharya Jiva Goswami also quotes a verse from the Srimad Bhagavatam, 1st Canto, chapter 10:48, Gudam param brahma manusha lingam, which refers to the Supreme Absolute Truth concealed in a human-like form. Since the Lord is pure, why do some people perceive Krishna's form and activities as impure? Acharya Jiva explains that those whose own hearts are impure cannot understand the pure Lord. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti further quotes the Lord's own instruction to Arjuna in Sri Hari Vamsa, Tat param paramam brahma sarvam vibhajate jagat mamaiva tad ganam tejo gaptam arhasi bharata. Superior to that total material nature is the supreme Brahman, from which this entire creation expands. O descendant of Bharata, you should know that the supreme Brahman consists of my concentrated effulgence. Thus, to save his devotee, Shiva now glorifies the supreme Lord, Krishna, his eternal worshipable master. The Lord's bewildering potency induced Shiva to fight with Lord Krishna, but now the fight is over, and to save his devotee, Lord Shiva offers these beautiful prayers. Om Gana Timirandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshun Militang Yena Tasmai Sri Guruve Namaha. Jai Sri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Sri Advaita Gadadhar Sri Vasadi Gaur Bhakta Vrinda. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. This is an extraordinarily inconceivable pastime of destruction, anger, and what seems to be lust. Let's begin by looking at Banasura. He is the oldest son of Bali Maharaj. Of Bali Maharaj's 100 sons, there's Banasura, the eldest. Yet, somehow or other, he did not manifest his father's bhakti. Although the Shastra describes that Banasura, in terms of behavior, even though he was a demon, was respectable and tidy in his dealings with others. Yet, by bad association, Banasura developed an aversion to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. That aversion to the Supreme Personality of Godhead is the natural result of material association. You may recall from the seventh canto of Bhagavatam that Prahlad expresses to Lord Nrsingadev that he is afraid of material existence. Then later he says he's not afraid of material existence. So what is Prahlad Maharaj meaning? First he says he's afraid of material existence because he's referring to the inevitable degradation of one's consciousness into offenses against the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Prahlad is not saying he's afraid of the miseries of material life per se. No, there's no question of that. As he says later, he's always absorbed in the Mahamrita, the great ocean of hearing and chanting about Krishna. So what is it that actually Prahlad's afraid of if it's not the setbacks, the debacles, the catastrophes of material life? What is he afraid of? He says he's afraid of the inevitable materialistic association that produces an attitude of aversion and rebellion. He says that's inevitable. As one rotates through the samsara chakra, the wheel of birth and death, it's naturally you pick up rebellious tendencies. It's naturally you pick up aversion toward the Supreme Personality of Godhead. And this is what happened with Banasura. He happened to please Lord Shiva. While Lord Shiva was absorbed in meditation on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Banasura, with his 1,000 arms, he was playing musical instruments as Lord Shiva danced his Tandava Nritya, his very special Lord Shiva dance. But that dance that Lord Shiva was doing involved his complete absorption on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Banasura assisted him, and therefore Lord Shiva was very merciful to Banasura. Banasura had a problem. I've got 1,000 arms. What do I do with them? He describes that having all these arms produced such a terrible itch to do something with them. This is the classic dilemma of the sense gratifier. It's not that the senses are your friends who will let you be peaceful. That can only happen when the senses are engaged in devotional service. But ordinarily, the senses literally drive you crazy. Of course, most persons today under the influence of the material energy don't want to admit that they're being driven crazy by their senses. Banasura was very honest to his master, Lord Shiva. I've got this itch. I don't know what to do with my arms. Sometimes I look for the elephants of the universe that guard all the directions, but even those elephants run away from me. I run at mountains and smash them with my arms, pulverize mountains, but still it's not enough. I think, Banasura implied very strongly, I think you, Lord Shiva, are the only one who can satisfy me in combat. He expressed it in a tactful way, because after all, you're my worshipful lord. I shouldn't be indirectly challenging you to a battle. But, you know, I've got these arms, you see. I've got this itch. Things happen. Lord Shiva expressed dissatisfaction and told Banasura, one day you'll meet your match. You will fight someone who will devastate you. What was Banasura's reaction? Ki jai. Why was he rejoicing? Because in no way did he take Lord Shiva's words to mean that he could be defeated. He thought he was indefeatable. But he just focused on the prediction that there'll be such a good fight coming. And of course, I'll win. Then we move to Banasura's daughter. The Shastra describes that some or other she had seen Parvati and Shiva relating toward one another as husband and wife. And Usha began to think to herself, oh, if I could also have an experience like that. So Parvati was very merciful to her and told her, on such and such a day, you'll have a dream of someone, and that person is your husband. And indeed, it happened like that. As you know, Usha cried out in the middle of the night, and her girlfriends all became alerted in the ladies' quarters. What's going on? And her special girlfriend, Chitralekha, asked her, can I help you find this person? The Acharyas point out that this searching of the person by Chitralekha and the recognition by Usha is a very rare happening. The ability to search and the ability to recognize based on Chitralekha's search is very, very rare in this world. Indeed, practically never happens. So, in other words, we're in the midst of a very inconceivable event. You know how Chitralekha brought back from Dwarka Aniruddha. And they were relating amorously in the ladies' quarters of the palace. The eunuchs guarding the ladies' quarters became very suspicious because they saw such joy. That was the prominent thing they saw. You may wonder why or how, most specifically, how did the eunuch guards of the ladies' quarters, the unmarried ladies' quarters, how did they get on to Usha? The main symptom they saw was her joyfulness, and that caused them to put 1 + 1 together. Why is a young girl so joyful? They're afraid of their own position. We need to go tell Banasur before he finds out, because otherwise we can be accused of being lax in our duties. So they inform Banasura, who came rushing to see who had spoiled his family. Ordinarily, such a thing is abominable, unheard of practically in Vedic culture. Last night, there was a drama about the East and the West. Some exaggerations there about America and India. So, one thing is true, though. Generally speaking, if such a situation was discovered in the West, what is the problem? What is the difficulty? In fact, I know in many families in New Zealand and Australia, especially New Zealand, wealthy families, prosperous families, educated families, if the parents find out the 13 or 14, 15-year-old daughter has some boyfriend, they say, bring him home, live with him at home. This is considered high class. Very aristocratic. Why should you meet in some park car or meet in some mall or movie theater? Just bring him home. You both can stay together. I was speaking to a group of devotees in Australia, and I was explaining this point. And right in the middle of the class, one devotee interrupted me. Maharaj, no. It wasn't like that with my family. My parents are very strict. When my sister's boyfriend would spend the night, my parents said, you cannot be in her room. You both have to stay in the living room. It was serious. It's very strict. Of course, we know such dealings are very abominable and very detrimental for the progress of the individual in society. Banasura is a demon. He's anti-Krishna. Yet, he recognizes, what is this? My daughter has been polluted. This is a disgrace to the entire family. So he immediately rushed there. Entered the quarters of the ladies. And he saw Aniruddha, who was so beautiful. Banasura did concede. Such a handsome young man. Definitely a perfect match for my beautiful daughter. He conceded that point. But at the same time, he became so angry. I just don't like the way this has happened. I just don't like the way these events have transpired. He may be handsome. He may be the perfect match. I don't care. He just lost his temper. That has to happen in material existence. You may evidence good qualities for a while. But because there's no connection to the Supreme Absolute Truth, you can be so easily capsized. Sometimes our devotees wonder, what is this verse? Yasyasti bhaktir bhagavati akinchana sarvai gunais taktra samasates. That if you are surrendered to the material energy, you can't have any good qualities. What does that mean? Sometimes it seems like those who are not serving Krishna's spiritual energy, seemed to be courteous, seemed to be well-mannered, even seemed to be charitable and caring. But what that verse is telling you is that such qualities cannot hold up. They can't survive the blows of illusory energy. They can't survive the temptations, the pushings of illusory energy. It's just a matter of time. Or even a matter of lifetimes before it's obvious that by material strength alone, you cannot resist the illusory energy dragging you down. So although Banasura has been described as having nice qualities because of his lack of connection to the Supreme Absolute Truth, he could so easily enter into a rage, even though he admitted, yes, this Aniruddha is looking quite an appropriate match for my daughter. But nevertheless, it's always amazing how contact with the material energy produces such irrationalities, such inconsistencies. This tendency has baffled humanity for millennia. Well, we just had a huge war. We expect that human beings will learn not to have such wars again. World War I. What is the other name for World War I? The war to end all wars. That's what people thought when World War I finished and 17 million persons were dead. They call it that. This is the war to end all wars. Never again will humanity make such a mistake. What happened 23 or so years later? World War II, over 50 million persons dead. After World War II ended, there was a great world gathering for making human rights official. They made up a charter of human rights that could not be violated even if persons in a democratic country voted to throw out these human rights. No, there was an international agreement. We never again want to see the atrocities that happened in World War II. Surely humanity has learned the lesson. Another example. In the USA, California, as you've heard, has a big water problem. So one of the solutions proposed is desalination. Huge industrial plants that take seawater, remove the salt, and in that way the water becomes usable for human purposes. There's only one problem with these desalination plants. The past history of them is a total failure. Some years ago in Australia, there was a huge drought. And so the government spent $10 billion, equivalent of $10 billion U.S. dollars, to make 4 or 5 desalination plants. So what's $10 billion, right? None of those plants have ever been in operation. Because after constructing them, the engineers realized it is too expensive to run them. Right. They didn't get their engineers from IIT, right? They should have gotten them. Not only did the desalination plants prove too expensive to run, but as soon as the 5 plants were built, then the rains came. Uncontrollably more rain than anyone had seen before. Only $10 billion, you know. What is the problem? What what we can do with $10 billion for Krishna's service. Srila Prabhupada always told us, Krishna is no poor person. When he sees that you are pure and advanced, he can give you the whole world. But anyway, the point is that this quest for material solutions is a very sinister process. There seems to be hope, but again and again, there is defeat. Maybe the defeat is a distance down the road. At first, everything looks good. We've got those desalination plants. We have defeated nature. But there's always some complication. So now in the USA, in California, they're talking about building desalination plants. They're worried, though. Total failure in Australia. But we have more knowledge now. It's always the human obsession. We know better now. We have more knowledge now. We'll do it right this time. If you study human history, you'll see. They cannot stop the material complications. They cannot stop the sequence, the train of material disadvantages. You only get to feel like you can do that. You get the hope. You block the problem here, the problem comes around another way. You lock the front door so the problem can't enter, the problem goes through the back door. That's the story of human history. This is why Srila Prabhupada says so emphatically in his purports, no material solution will ever solve the problems of material existence. Maybe you think, well, that's a strong statement. Maybe it's a bit of exaggeration just to make us fired up and chanting Hare Krishna. Some things seem to be working. Seem to be working. But real solutions mean to deal with the root cause of material existence. That's the only solution that is practical. Prahlad Maharaj was not speaking poetry merely when he said that the so-called remedies are worse than the problem the remedies were meant to solve. You can think, oh, Prahlad, you know, he's 5 years old and he's really absorbed in smadhanam. He's so focused in samadhi on the Supreme Personality of Godhead that he says things like that. But we don't take them directly. We don't take them with critical intelligence. Because we are human beings. We are educated. We'll solve the problems. Yes, we should try to minimize the impact of human destructiveness. We should try to make it so that there can be some reducing in the miseries human beings cause for themselves and their own society. At the same time, we know that the real solution means to get to the root of material existence and deal with that root. In this way, bhakti is hard for many people to understand. Often they want to know, are you this worldly or are you otherworldly? Are you dealing with this world or are you simply focused on the hereafter? They're always sizing you up in that way. What are you doing about the real world? Your prayers are nice. Your songs are nice. Your food is very nice. But what are you doing about the real world? Then you tremble. You may get intimidated. It is difficult for people to see how it's possible to have an integrated approach to living in this world. An integrated approach means that while dealing with the eternal necessities, you're also dealing with the immediate necessities. This is the inconceivable brilliance of Bhagavad Gita. Simultaneously, as when Krishna tells Arjuna, Mamana bhava mad bhakto madhyaji mam namaskaru, always think of me, become my devotee, surely you'll come to me. At the same time, he's telling Arjuna, fight in the battle. Mama nusra yujjam cha, fight and think of me. So Bhagavad Gita is going on two levels simultaneously. Such a mystery can only be understood in the association of devotees. All right, back to Banasura. He notices that Aniruddha is not afraid in the slightest. Aniruddha doesn't even move to run away. He doesn't even show any symptom that he's changing his... He's changing the scene. He's just there with Usha, and they're relaxing. Who is this person coming? So Banasura was astonished how much composure Aniruddha had. Of course, who is Aniruddha? He's the fourth member of the Chaturvyuha. He's the super soul of all jivas. From him expands the Lord of Svetadvip. Don't ask me any more technical details about Chaturvyuha, please. So, he's no ordinary entity. So then you ask, why is it that eventually Aniruddha seemed to have been conquered? He dispatched all of Banasura's soldiers. He took a bar made of special iron. It wasn't ordinary iron. And he just finished off so many of Banasura's soldiers that Banasura sent to arrest Aniruddha. And finally, Banasura used a special weapon from Lord Shiva to arrest Aniruddha. How do you arrest a member of the Chaturvyuha? The Acharyas explain, Krishna allowed all this to happen because Krishna wanted to enjoy fighting with Banasura. All right, yes, you can detain Aniruddha, my grandson, because this will lead to a great fight, a fight in which I can enjoy, and also a fight in which my supremacy will be established by Lord Shiva. So therefore, although Aniruddha was missing for so long from Dwarka, Krishna didn't mind. It was a setup. The whole situation was a setup for Krishna's pleasure and for Krishna teaching a powerful lesson about Lord Shiva. Inevitably, the time came for the battle. As Krishna, Balaram, so many of the Vrishni dynasty went to this city of Banasura. And Banasura had a benediction, remember, from Lord Shiva, that Lord Shiva would be the guardian of his capital city. This is why Lord Shiva played such an important role in the impending battle. Banasura was his devotee. He was compassionate to Banasura, even though he was angry at Banasura's inability to control his senses, and even implying to Lord Shiva, look, it seems like the only thing I can do with these thousand arms is to fight with you. I don't know anyone else who's suitable. Still, because Banasura had assisted Lord Shiva playing musical instruments while Lord Shiva danced in meditation on the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Lord Shiva became the guardian of his city. So you know about the huge battle that happened. Again, Banasura's anger gets the best of him, just as it did when he first saw Aniruddha with his daughter. Now his anger knew no limits as he watched Krishna destroy his whole army. You might say there's no point in Banasura being humble about it. He's a Kshatriya. But the devastation was so thorough that you'd think he would add 1 + 1 = 2, that I should surrender to this Krishna. Of course, the whole battle is giving Krishna pleasure. Then there was the confrontation between the Shiva Dwar and the Vishnu Dwar. Banasura now has no options. He personally attacks Krishna. And what does Krishna do as Chakrayuda, the holder of the chakra? The Acharyas described that that chakra moved so fast it was invisible. All you could see is one arm after another of Banasura falling off. The chakra was practically invisible. It was moving so fast. Finally, Banasura was left with 4 arms. At that point, Lord Shiva intervened. Because of Lord Shiva's intervention, Krishna stopped. All right, leave him with 4 arms. Besides the intervention of Lord Shiva, also, Krishna reminded everyone that I promised Prahlad I wouldn't kill anyone in his dynasty. And Banasura is the son of Bali Maharaj, who's in Prahlad Maharaj's family line. So again, you see the power of a devotee. Lord Shiva, the devotee, is intervening. And Krishna is also remembering his dealings with his devotee, Prahlad, whom he promised not to disturb his family line, not to kill anyone. So for all these reasons, Krishna left Banasura with 4 arms. You may wonder, what was the future of Banasura? The Leela in the 10th canto ends with Banasura allowing Aniruddha and Usha to ride on the chariot, go back to Dwarka. What happened to him? In the 11th canto, you'll read that Banasura actually went back to Godhead. What? Because he had the association of Lord Shiva, and he also had the association of Krishna. So somehow or other, after some time, all that association made Banasura qualified enough to go back to Godhead and be one of the associates of the Lord. Such happenings make you wonder. And then when you consider the mercy of Krishna as Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, you wonder even more. Last week, I received news from one devotee about how her grandmother left the world. Not Indian family, totally no religion whatsoever, no thought of religion, just totally secular. Well-off family, but no trace of Dharma in the slightest. And the grandmother was about to leave the world. And then the father of this devotee, who likes devotees, but again, no spiritual practices whatsoever, not even vegetarian. In the last moment, because the grandmother was leaving her body at home with the family, at the last moment, as she's taking her last breath and about to leave, the father, who's a total non-devotee, chants the Maha Mantra in her ear. This makes you wonder, what's going on here? We cannot say, of course, how much she heard, but still, just think of the inconceivably rare occurrence of someone leaving this world as someone chants the Maha Mantra in their ear. Whether devotee or not, just the occurrence itself is so special. And indeed so special when the person involved is a total non-devotee all the life. 90 years of non-devotee activities. And the father, he has some appreciation because his daughter is a devotee, but he's not even vegetarian yet. Here his mother is departing, and as she departs, he's speaking the Maha Mantra into her ear. Krishna's mercy is beyond our calculation. Therefore, even Banasura went back to Godhead because he had some kind of association that was beneficial, even though he was so angry. This whole Leela makes us think that somehow or other we have to get the association of devotees. That is the crowning success of our life. If Banasura could benefit the way he was behaving, certainly we can benefit by constant favorable association with devotees. In this verse and purport, Lord Shiva says, "You alone are the absolute truth, the supreme light, the mystery hidden within the verbal manifestation of the absolute. Those whose hearts are spotless can see you, for you are uncontaminated like the sky." Let us think about this point, those whose hearts are spotless can see you. That point is a major difference between Eastern and Western knowledge, or more particularly Vedic knowledge and Western speculation. Western speculation means, what does your heart have to do with what you can know? What is all this talk about spotless hearts? This is some kind of delusion. Uncontaminated hearts. Knowing has nothing to do with your so-called purity. No, what you can know has nothing to do with how you behave. In other words, the Western speculative process has stripped the activity of knowing into something that has no relation to the quality of your life, to the quality of your consciousness. Therefore, Western speculators protest this point. They get very disturbed. Those whose hearts are spotless can see you. What is all this talk? Everything is relative. Do as you like. Just do it. The more free you act, the more healthy your psychology is. India has so many repressions still. At least for another 10 years. Whereas in the Western world, whatever you feel, you immediately do. It's all based on your desire. And as your desire changes, well, your life can change. Why not? After death, everything is finished. Just live according to your desires at the moment, and you're a successful human being. But to say that knowledge, what you know, depends on whether your heart is spotless or not, oh, this is so primitive. This is Hindu granny folklore. They fail to understand that knowledge is state-specific. That is the Vedic stance. According to your state of consciousness, that determines what you can understand. Therefore, someone who has purified consciousness will know things that someone who doesn't can't. This thought is, this. Try to understand, this concept is so intimidating to the Western mentality. What do you mean, just because my consciousness is not pure, that I can't understand Bhagavad Gita? That's the kind of arrogance you're dealing with. They think it's all about belief. Oh, what you're really saying is because I haven't adopted your belief system, therefore I cannot understand. But if I would simply believe, then I would be saved. So I think it's all about accepting some kind of religious precepts. And you repeat it. I believe this, I believe that. Okay, now I can understand. They don't accept that. But they think that's what you mean when you say, those whose hearts are spotless, means those who have accepted a belief system. They signed up for certain religious beliefs. And that means they can understand more than someone who hasn't? The whole question of consciousness and the purity of consciousness eludes Western knowledge. First of all, they have to understand consciousness. And then they need to understand purified, refined, distilled consciousness. So this is the dividing line. The bhakti yogis know that your behavior influences your consciousness, and your consciousness allows you to understand certain things or not understand them. That's why Krishna says to Arjuna, I'm speaking Bhagavad Gita to you because bhaktosime sakacheti. You're my devotee and friend. You've got the right consciousness, the right state of mind. Therefore, you can understand this ancient mystery. It's not a question of Arjuna being some kind of true believer. It's all about Arjuna having the right consciousness, and therefore, because of that right consciousness, he can perceive and understand what Krishna is saying. And that's why Krishna is talking to him. I was speaking in Chicago last month at a gathering of devotees, and I brought up a point that materialistic scientists often bring up, that you devotees and others like you, you talk about that there is a spirit soul and that there is a supreme soul. You talk like that. But such claims are so extraordinary. Because we don't see any spirit soul. We don't see any supreme soul. Don't you get it? So how can you make such an extraordinary claim then? You don't see it. Your scientific instruments don't reveal that. So why do you accept this? So then they say something that supposedly should make you shake in your seat. Extraordinary claims require extraordinary evidence. Oh, what am I going to say now? We don't see any spirit soul. We don't see any supreme soul. Yes, that's true. It's an extraordinary claim. Where's my evidence? In other words, they really boxed you up. You can't even present ordinary evidence. You have to present extraordinary evidence because your claim is so extraordinary. Now you tremble. Oh, no. You feel embarrassed. Maybe I'm just a religious true believer. But you can turn the tables. You say that consciousness comes from matter. You say that consciousness consciousness comes from inanimate matter, life comes from matter. This is an extraordinary claim. You have empowered matter with so many inconceivable potencies, achinchashakti. Please, for this extraordinary claim, present the extraordinary evidence. So this is why Krishna in Bhagavad Gita says, Drabhuta Saga Lokesmin Daivasrevacha. They're just two classes of person. Each one says, you're making extraordinary claims. We're not going to agree. You say that if someone points out there is a spirit soul, there is a supreme soul, that's extraordinary. And we say, you point out that everything comes from matter. You have such faith in matter. You're investing matter with so many inconceivable shaktis. Well, that's an extraordinary claim. Where's your extraordinary evidence? In this way, the two will not meet. Yet, as you saw with Banasura, by association, things can change. Even an asura like Bana, he eventually went back to Godhead. Meanwhile, amidst this whole adventure, Krishna has enjoyed. That's the bottom line. All right, any questions? Yes.
Thank you, Maharaj. You made a statement that our behavior affects our consciousness. I was also thinking that the consciousness affects the behavior, so how does it work?
Your consciousness is the decisive factor. As you say, the consciousness affects the behavior affects the consciousness. So this is why we focus on a lifestyle for purifying the consciousness, enhancing the consciousness, and therefore we can understand more. As stated in Bhagavad Gita, the soul is both conscious and consciousness. So, you cannot separate consciousness from the spirit soul, just like you cannot separate the sunshine from the sun. So yes, your activities influence your consciousness. If you act in such a way that you bring upon yourself negative influences, your consciousness will degrade. And similarly, wherever you go, you're taking your consciousness with you. You may clean up the environment, which is a nice thing, of course. We support that. But we know that unless you clean up your consciousness, you're going to make a mess again. So in this way, again, we're double-edged. And sometimes people become bewildered. Make up your mind. Do you want to worry about the environment, or do you want to worry about consciousness? One or the other. He said, we do both. We see the correlation between the two. We see the correlation between consciousness and behavior, behavior and consciousness. We see the correlation between the environment and consciousness and the environment. By Krishna's mercy on us, we see the whole package, an integrated package. That vision is so rare. That is the special vision, the special scientific vision of a Krishna Bhakta, to see the whole package and how the various elements of that package interrelate. You cannot see the whole package unless you know the source and take your knowledge from the source. By taking knowledge from the source, from Krishna, we know how to deal with Krishna's energies and we know how to live a balanced life because we're taking our knowledge from the source of all the energies. Therefore, we can know the skill of how to balance the energies. So devotees are not intimidated by the material energy because they recognize who the proprietor is. By recognizing the proprietor of the material energy and following the proprietor's instructions how to deal with that energy, you can successfully deal with the material energy, which baffles so many persons. Let's stop war, or let's stop the drought, or let's do this, let's do that. We say, yes, you can try. Go ahead. It's a good thing to try to stop these things, but at the same time, you have to be acting in a higher way. So it seems like we talk double talk, right? And we do. We're double talkers. I remember once Srila Prabhupada speaking double talk at New Vrindavan. He said, "We are not against the advancement of materialistic society, even though it's suicidal." Any other questions? Yes.
Hare Krishna. Maharaj, you were speaking about a Vaishnava is this worldly also and otherworldly also, and he balances this. Mm-hmm. So would you throw some more light on how to not go to the extremes that I'm both, but then sometimes I tend to go otherworldly and then neglect the duties of this world, or sometimes I focus too much on duties of this world and neglect the otherworldly feature of devotion to God?
Yes, that is why bhakti always requires guidance. Krishna makes this point so clear in Bhagavad Gita. That's why he says, Tadvidi Pranipatena. If you want to know how to handle this double reality, if you want to know the truth of how to live in the world but not be of the world, if you want to know that highest applied spiritual technology, then you need guidance. Inbuilt into the bhakti endeavor is the need for guidance. Otherwise, we can become baffled. We'll forget that dealing with the material energy can often be baffling because the energy itself is pure bafflement. Everyone runs up against this sooner or later. Why did this happen? I can't understand it. Why? Why me, or why that one, or why? Even Yudhisthira, after the battle of Kurukshetra, why? Just to make me king. Look at all the havoc I've caused. Just as Arjuna predicted when he spoke before the battle, why he shouldn't fight, that society will be destroyed, religious principles will be destroyed, families will become polluted, Varna Sankar will be born. Just as he said, it happened. And it's all because of me. By Krishna's arrangement, of course, Yudhisthira was baffled. So much so that even Krishna couldn't solve his bafflement. And as you know, of course, Krishna wanted Bhishmadev to get the credit for solving Yudhisthira's bafflement so that Yudhisthira would take the throne and do his service. Part of humility means to understand that the material energy is puzzling and baffling, and that's the way it is. Some other we have this notion that the material world is just waiting there for us to understand. Real humility means to know that will never happen. There'll always be the baffling, bewildering effect of material nature. It's never going to change. It's a tiger that never changes its stripes. That's why Krishna says, Daivyesha gunamai mamamaya dharaya. Yeah. You can only handle the material energy if you take my instruction. That's the only way. Otherwise, you'll perpetually be baffled. So in this way, the Krishna Bhakta is very practical. The topmost engineer. Someone who can deal with the double reality as a daily occurrence. Anything else? Yes.
Thank you, Maharaj, for your enlightening class. Just would like to know that it's very difficult to accept that Lord Shiva is choosing a pleasure-based decision over principle. Like, because Banasur pleased Lord Shiva, therefore he went against the principle to please Krishna.
Oh, Lord Shiva was pleasing Krishna by his battle. And also, especially his prayers that you're going to hear now. They're pleasing to Krishna. It's all a setup for Krishna to enjoy. Otherwise, no one can defeat Aniruddha. Banasura couldn't arrest Aniruddha. But the whole setup led to Krishna's pleasure. Such a battle. Balaram was there too. Lord Shiva played his part in the Leela and then spoke prayers acknowledging the supremacy of Krishna. Even Lord Shiva's weapon, the Shiva Jwara, acknowledged the supremacy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. This is all for Krishna's pleasure. And after all is said and done, Aniruddha, the fourth member of the Chaturvyuha, gets his girl. This is Achyuta, infallible enjoyer. We should be envious, right? The Supreme should be simply impersonal, or the Supreme should be non-existent, but Supreme Godhead as a Supreme enjoyer? No, we don't want that. But if God can become our order supplier, that's okay. Then we acknowledge his existence. But simply that the Supreme Personality of God exists for himself, of himself. That's what we want. We want to exist for ourselves, of ourselves. We want to be self-sufficient enjoyers. Therefore, what Krishna does is mythology, and what we do in our attempts to enjoy, that is fact. So Lord Shiva gave pleasure to the Supreme Personality of Godhead by his prayers. You alone are the absolute truth, the supreme light, the mystery hidden within the verbal manifestation of the absolute. Those whose hearts are spotless can see you, for you are uncontaminated like the sky. So I thank you very much for your kind attention. Hare Krishna.